But the core of the game is just the Skill Master system, and there is no story or existing world development. These games should be numerous on the market, with too many people just slapping a game together and calling it ready. Tsubaki hesitated again, before voicing her main question. If you don't think it will succeed, why are you allowing Ashley to publish it? I glanced towards Tsubaki with a small smile. For experience. And so that she can obtain the necessary code for the new system. After this game, I plan to tell Ashley to hold back on any more projects until she is ready to create NPCs for the games she makes. Tsubaki's eyes widened when she heard that. Won't that take quite a long time? She asked. Though I honestly didn't think so. Not if we take what already exists in the world and modify it just enough to make it work. I plan on pointing her towards a template that was created a while back. Speaking of, do you know how Anna is doing? When I asked that, Tsubaki seemed to understand. To my knowledge, Anna has retired from her teaching position due to being unable to keep pace with the constantly evolving technological and magical developments. Furthermore, as she is not a fully awakened magical intelligence, there is a limit to her capabilities. I gave a small nod at that. Anna was my original attempt at creating a sentient artificial intelligence, using the card magic of Deccan as a form of object-oriented programming. The result could be compared to an extremely high-functioning chatbot that had its own understanding of human emotions developed through a period of observation. If Anna's base concept was taken and used as the template for NPCs, changing their programming just enough so that they had a survival instinct comparable to humans, they would be able to create decent NPCs without worrying about souls. I doubted that they would perform as well as the NPCs in Fragments of Acidia, but something like those found in Vision Expanse shouldn't be difficult to pull off. This was the drawback to making games the simple method through the system, and also why Sarah's games were so popular. Although she took the time to create them, they had their own concepts and stories behind them, and there was far more for the players to do than simply play in an open sandbox. At the very least, a sandbox game needed its own unique system, similar to how World Seed combined the trees with the Elemental Seed magic system, as well as monster taming. On the other hand, there is a target audience for Ascension in my world. People will likely view it as an emergency measure taken by us to give people an alternate path to strength. The Skillmaster system gives a safe way for anyone to obtain a domain, outside of Divine Forging or the chambers that James and his group made. Theoretically, anyone could put in enough effort and become a god with up to 3 domains, achieving their own trinity. The concept of a trinity might be seen as outdated, now that the divine circuits were popularized, but there were still certain benefits to be found in the stability it provided. Furthermore, the surplus of options made it popular for people to seek more than one domain. I understand. Tsubaki nodded her head. In that case, do you plan on having any of us seek domains in this way? I shook my head at that. You and Lifra are already goddesses with your own trinities. I don't even think the game will be decent for your trials, compared to what Codex Chaotic can provide. After I said that, Tsubaki's ear flinched slightly, and I had clearly caught on to one of the main reasons that she asked about trying the game. Honestly, I think that the next game should be made with Lifra's help. Tsubaki blinked in confusion when I said that, tilting her head. Lifra, making a video game? Tsubaki acted like she couldn't imagine Lifra typing a line of code, let alone an entire program. I let out a light laugh, reading her expression. Not making the game, but the story. If Ashley can incorporate a story written by Lifra into the game's code, she might be able to set that as the goal for the NPCs of that world to strive towards. Think of it like how Fragments of Acidia has an already established storyline, and yet there is no direct sign of Sarah or anyone else from her team having visited the world. This means that the world evolved towards its current direction in a guided manner, which we can confirm because we have been forced to launch the game twice. It has a history, but none that would directly link to Sarah herself. Otherwise, people with powers related to time could observe the history of the world from before its purchase to find clues about her, and I'm confident that Sarah wouldn't make a mistake like that. Tsubaki nodded her head, seeming to follow my train of thought. So, you believe that her team contains someone specialized in writing divine stories, similar to Lyphra? It might not be divine, might be a fallen god or someone with an extremely weird saint energy. Either way, she definitely has someone writing an extensive world overview every time she makes one of her games. Chapter 89. Amidst the news of the destruction of so many ships, people couldn't find much solace in the new game that was announced by Dark Flame Technologies. Many treated the game as a way to distract the public from the horrible news. Of course, there were a few die-hard fans that cared more about the game than others, but they were ultimately the minority. Around the same time, another piece of news was released to the public. Great progress had been achieved related to fifth-tier magic. A research paper was submitted anonymously to an elven magic college in Gandor, containing countless new patterns to apply to the microscopic fifth-tier spell formations. According to this research paper, fifth-tier geometric spells could be measured as grains, with each spell formation equivalent to a grain of sand. A true fifth-tier spell would only be achieved when a minimum of 10 grains were cast together. However, whether it was the cost, the complexity, or the compression, fifth-tier magic was far beyond the reach of almost all mortals. Perhaps for that reason a magic item had been submitted with the research paper as a proof of concept, which was immediately taken by the Queen of Gandor as a national treasure. This magic item was a glass sphere, enchanted with a fifth-tier spell that had 10 grains. According to the instructions that accompanied the item, this was an intelligent magic item that would activate whenever a hazardous event occurred to the area that it was protecting. Once the event was detected to transpire, the item would activate, analyzing the situation and determining the appropriate course of action. Compared to a fourth-tier spell, these 10 grains of the fifth tier were capable of unleashing countless variations of spells, whether offense, defense, healing, or even directly beseeching the goddess of magic. When the news of this item appeared, people began to speculate who had submitted it. Some believed that it may have been the goddess herself, but others denied this. If it were so, why would she submit an anonymous paper? Instead, with her personality, she would boldly proclaim her achievements to the world. This led them to believe that it may have been a secret disciple of Rian that was doing her best to contribute to the world while remaining hidden from the public eye. Finally, the last piece of news that was revealed within these few weeks. The Another World Research Group announced the beginning of their world creation experiments. This led to a series of mixed responses. Some were hopeful for the power to create worlds being in the hands of mortals, while others felt as though new universes weren't anything new. After all, you could step through the fairy ring without a key and arrive at a previously unexplored universe. When it came time for the experiment, a large number of fallen gods were mobilized as guardians to allow normal people who wanted to attend to witness the demonstration. They seemed to be taking this very seriously, perhaps to make amends for their previous blunder. Chelsea was the one performing the demonstration, her voice appearing in everyone's minds. "Today, I have 5 devices that I am intending to test, each with slightly different settings. Due to these differences in settings, I am only expecting 1 or 2 of the devices to work properly. Even that would be considered a great success. Fallen gods, please make sure that no void monsters approach the area, and that the void influence does not erode the bystanders." After saying that, she pulled out a small metal orb with a single red button. The void is merely a mass of information. Because of this, it does not take a grand machine to create something like a world within the void. Instead, all that is required is a medium that can interface with the void and transform that information. Saying so, Chelsea pressed the button on the device and threw it forward. Everyone waited, and then suddenly saw how the red and black energy of the void seemed to converge on the item like a vortex. Chelsea stood at the front of the assembly, arms crossed in front of herself, as she watched the event unfold. This was uncharted territory, even for herself. In truth, she would have preferred avoiding making this a public display, but it couldn't be helped. There was no way that they could completely block off the void from travel, so there were always going to be witnesses. If that was the case, it was better to have the witnesses in a controlled environment, as opposed to them interfering in the experiment. Still, she kept her attention focused, monitoring the process. The energy was converging into a writhing sphere, bubbling all along its surface. Chelsea shook her head, realizing that this attempt did not have the stability necessary to solidify the world barrier. With a wave of her hand, she erected a giant shield within the void, blocking the view for herself and the spectators behind. The spectators were briefly confused before the shield trembled from an impact, cracks forming along it. When the shield was lowered, the world that had started to take shape was no more. Even the spherical device that had initiated the process could not be seen. As I said, failures are normal here. Chelsea's voice was calm as she dispersed the chaotic energy, letting the void settle before throwing out the second sphere. For the most part, this process went much the same as the first one. Seeing this, the audience naturally believed that this was another failure, as nothing had changed. However, to Chelsea, there was indeed a startling change. The sphere that was created in this attempt was contorting, but it was not bubbling. Chelsea kept herself ready to produce a shield at any moment, but wanted to see this through as much as she could. The world laws that had been designed for this sphere were identical to those found in Earth's universe, so she was hopeful for a certain degree of stability. The sphere continued to grow, finally coming to a halt after 5 long minutes. Once done, it seemed pristine, with a swirling nebula of energy rotating within it. It appears that a world has been created. I will send an avatar inside to investigate and transmit the scene for everyone here to see. As Chelsea said that, she produced a large screen above her head and a clone of herself in front of her. The clone walked over to the sphere and could see just how thin the world barrier was. If she wasn't careful, she could accidentally pierce it by mistake. It was clear that the digital conversion system wouldn't be usable in this universe, for fear of puncturing the barrier. Carefully, the avatar opened a portal, taking a full 30 seconds to do so while ensuring that her actions were not damaging the world she was infiltrating. After that time, she vanished from view, and the screen lit up to display what the avatar saw. There was a swirling cloud of multicolored gases that stretched out through space. It would appear that this world was created without any form of time acceleration. Because of this, cosmic dust has only just scattered throughout the universe, and we would need a great deal of time to wait for any planets to form. Perhaps the world's barrier would become more solid as the space within stabilizes over time. Chelsea brought her avatar out of the world as she narrated, before addressing the crowd again. This can be considered a small success. However, because this world is incapable of producing life without waiting for billions of years, and its barrier is so weak, I will be disposing of it. The alternative is to allow a void beast to do so and risk them gaining a modifier similar to those that attacked during V-Day. At first, the crowd wanted to resist the idea of destroying an entire universe. However, at the mention of V-Day, their protests died down before they could arise. Despite it having transpired decades ago, the effects were still being felt in the present day. Seeing nobody object to her decision, Chelsea lightly slashed out with her hand, a blade formed within the void, popping the fragile bubble that was the world. She noted to herself that the laws of the world seemed at least somewhat stable, as she hadn't felt any disturbance in her avatar when it was sent into the world. Like this, the third and fourth tests progressed, each ending in an explosive collapse. On the fifth test, however, a result similar to the second appeared. This surprised Chelsea, as the world barrier for this test was firmer than that of the second. It was still a far cry short of a system-created world, but she wasn't in danger of popping it with just a casual gesture. The density of this world barrier can be compared to those that had been created for the improved void generators in the past, Chelsea noted, sharing her observations with the crowd. However, this world is similarly in a state of cosmic infancy. Because of this, I will once again terminate the world. This time there was less resistance to her suggestion, as they still clearly remembered her words from earlier. Thankfully, with these worlds being lifeless, there was no risk of karmic backlash like what James had previously faced. When she lashed out, the world first cracked and then began to dissolve in front of them. Chelsea turned to address the crowd with a firm nod. As you can see, we have made great strides in our research. In time, we hope to be able to create fully functioning worlds, all with technology reproducible with mortal means. For now, I'd like to ask the fallen gods present to escort everyone here back to their universe of origin. After she said that, Chelsea took her leave, returning to the research base with the observations that she had gained from this experiment. Sprigga sat on a large tree overlooking a lush forest. There was a melancholic look on her face, which she was doing her best to hide. This tree she was on now was one of her cuttings, having come here with the vessels that established the hyperlane network in the area. As this was related to the safety of her daughters, she had to witness the process firsthand. Thankfully, those in charge agreed to her request and allowed her to remain behind when they left. Now she was doing her best to hide her loneliness from her daughter, who was managing the grove below. She only allowed her true feelings to show on her face at moments like this, when she knew that she was alone, or at least that's what she believed.
"You know, if you go around looking like that, someone might get the wrong idea," a voice spoke up to Sprigga from behind, causing her eyes to shoot wide open. She jumped to her feet, turning around. Standing behind her was a figure that she thought she wouldn't see again, or at least not in the same form.
But your incarnation, you haven't changed," Sprigga noted, causing Giles to chuckle slightly.
"I've just picked my incarnation," he assured her, stepping forward to caress her cheek. "Do you have any idea how hard it is to find a pair of elven and merkin parents? I couldn't find a pair that was expecting any time soon, so I'll be reborn as the child of a pair of elves in Spica. I've already made the arrangements."
"Then how are you here?" Sprigga asked in confusion.
"This is just a projection. Because I was a fallen god, I can project myself from the void. It's not easy to do this, admittedly. I guess that goes to show how effective the barriers are. As I am now, I can't utilize any of my power, and can only project my physical form. I just wanted to let you know."
Sprigga nodded her head, a bright smile blooming on her face as she lifted her hand up to grab his.
"Spica, right? I'll be waiting for you, so hurry up, and don't keep me waiting any longer."
Chapter 90 Lifra hummed lightly to herself as she skated along the icy tunnel on the 62nd layer of Fior. Her right arm had changed into the shape of a sword, which she was using to cut down any monsters that tried to intercept her path. While the other worlds were dealing with their mimetic crisis, Fior was essentially unaffected by this news. Instead, they were still focused on boring a giant tunnel through the ice, wanting to uncover the next layer's gate. By this point, they had long since made a secure gate's rest on this floor, with numerous layers of defense against the monsters swimming through the ice. However, it was not as easy to secure the tunnel itself, as it was constantly expanding. For that reason, several gods and high-ranking adventurers were tasked with regularly patrolling the tunnel and slaying any monsters that emerged. On the bright side, the machine used to create the tunnel had been significantly improved, and the people divining the location of the next gate said that they should reach it any day now. For Lifra's part, this was rather boring, and she would have rather been running off on an adventure through the stars. Despite her urge to explore uncharted lands and fight spectacular monsters,
She was aware of the inherent dangers when it came to fighting against mimetic creatures. For that reason, she had chosen not to give in to her intrusive thoughts. She let out a low yawn as she skated at ever-increasing speeds through the tunnel, her sword arm occasionally slashing out to strike at an unfortunate monster. She had lost track of how far she had gone in the tunnel, barely noting that the angle of the slope had changed just slightly. This must have been one of the checkpoints where they confirmed the location of the portal. Thinking that, she leaned forward, speeding up. Far ahead, she could begin to see the machine, as well as numerous people crowding around it. Squinting her eyes, she thought that they might be in a defensive formation, as if a dangerous monster had appeared. Her legs tensed, and she kicked at the ground to accelerate even more, turning into a blur that quickly traversed the remaining distance. Soon she skidded to a stop next to the machine, kicking up a cloud of shaved ice.
"What's going on?" she asked in concern, readying her sword arm to attack.
"Lady Lyphra," one of the Dova workers looked at her in surprise. "We found it."
"Found it?"
Lyphra blinked, her brain momentarily lagging as she left alert mode. Once she realized what they meant, her eyes went wide.
"We've got the gate? We can get out of this frozen tube?"
The workers chuckled when they saw Lyphra's reaction, nodding their heads. They led her off to the side around the machine, and Lyphra saw the black gate standing tall, covering the way forward. "We were just about to request a transport unit to send us back to base camp, so that we could report the findings."
"No need,"
Lyphra shouted excitedly, her sword arm returning to normal as she ran forward.
"Everyone, come here."
As she said that, she held a hand forward, creating a golden portal. The workers smiled, recognizing this as the work of a priestess of Aurevi. With thankful nods, they walked forward, leaving Lyphra alone within the tunnel. Once the portal closed, Lyphra gave a playful grin. Now she was alone with the gate.
Now, Lyphra, you can't just charge in all willy-nilly. What would you do if there is a mimetic effect on the other side, or some kind of super dangerous monster, or some corrosive mist like the last floor?"
"You're right, Lyphra.
But I want to do it,"
Lyphra talked to herself, going so far as to create a clone to converse with.
"Besides, worst-case scenario, I get zapped to the boss's place, right? It'll be fine."
"No, bad Lyphra," her clone scolded,
clearly playing the role of the voice of reason.
"You can't just risk your life like that. You know the boss would say the same thing. That insurance policy is a last resort only. There are procedures to follow. In times like this, you should create an independently functioning clone, sever the mental connection, and send the clone through. Then, after letting the clone operate, allow it to return and write a report about the other side of the gate. Take that report, screen the information for mimetic influence, and then, if it is safe, you can enter yourself."
Lyphra stared at her clone for several long seconds.
"You just want me to send you first?"
What? No, that's definitely not true. It's just standard safety procedures. That's right."
The clone nodded her head rapidly, causing Lyphra to let out a small grin.
"Really? Then I suppose you won't mind if I create another clone to handle that job, since it's such an important and hazardous task. I wouldn't want to put you in danger."
The clone's already pale face somehow went even more white.
What? But, I mean, if it's for your sake, I would gladly sacrifice myself. There's no need to go through the trouble of making additional clones."
Lyphra simply rolled her eyes.
"All right. This one slime comedy routine is starting to get old. You've got 5 minutes before I go in after you."
The clone's eyes sparkled, and she jumped through the gate without giving Lyphra any time to regret her decision. As the gate opened a portal for her, Lyphra briefly saw what looked like a smooth stone surface on the other side, and flashing lights. Immediately she began to tap her foot, pacing back and forth in front of the gate. She had to resist the urge to just jump through, as the new protocols had been put in place for a reason. Even if she was reckless, she wasn't just going to throw her life away for nothing. Minutes passed, and Lyphra looked as if she was about to charge into the gate to save her unfortunate clone.
Surely she must have been in some grave danger to not immediately report back. However, before she could step forward, the gate opened, and the clone stepped back. Only there was something different about her now. The clone wore what appeared to be sunglasses and held a large bucket of some glowing snack in one arm. Additionally, she had a black shirt over her torso instead of Lifra's usual blue and white armor.
"What happened?" Lifra asked,
and the clone grinned.
"That was awesome!"
She threw her free hand up.
"It's like a whole city over there. You've got to try it out. Oh, also, these little popcorn energy kernels are great. We got to get the recipe."
Lifra paused before suddenly raising a hand to say something. However, the clone took one of the snacks from the bucket and threw it into Lifra's opening mouth, causing her eyes to widen. She let out an unconscious gasp of glee.
"Okay, spill. How'd you get this stuff? There's no way that you had the local currency for a new culture."
The clone simply snickered.
"They use basic energies as a secondary currency. I just had to get the local language off of some random passerby, and then I went shopping." "You were only gone for 5 minutes.
"There were nearby shops?" "The Black Gate's apparently some kind of tourist attraction," the clone snickered. Lifra let out a long sigh.
"Let's report back to the others. Petra will want to visit herself, and you know the boss definitely wants to hear about this place."
I let out a small sigh, closing the chat window that had appeared. The new month passed over, and so Bellarose noticed that I was his next opponent. He sent me a message, greeting me and letting me know that he had a list of trade offers, if I wanted to browse through them. I didn't see any reason to immediately refuse, so agreed to look it over if he sent the list.
"Dale!"
A familiar voice broke me out of my thoughts, just as I was thinking about looking through the list. Blinking, I looked at the door of my office, which was soon flung open by an energetic slime wearing a pair of sunglasses. "Lifra? What's going on? Please tell me that there hasn't been another disaster."
"Huh? Oh, no, no disaster. Good news, very good news," Lifra said,
and I sat up just a bit straighter to listen.
"The 63rd floor of Fior is unlocked. Also, it's an inhabited area with a great big city surrounding the gate."
I furrowed my brow, looking at Lifra. "You already explored it?"
"Huh? No. No, I sent a clone in, like you said. She didn't go far, just spending 5 minutes, but she got these cool sunglasses there. Get this, they regulate the level of light you see with mana, so whether it's super bright or dark out, you see things just as clear."
I blinked, nodding my head. I thought I had heard of something similar in my own world at one point, but it wasn't exactly an incredibly innovative invention, so I didn't pay much attention to it. "Well, what are the local life forms like?" Lifra paused, blinking.
"Oh, right."
She stretched out an arm, summoning a clone of herself wearing a black shirt.
"I haven't absorbed her memories yet, just in case, so she can tell you."
The clone nodded her head.
"They look like elves for the most part," she answered with a bright smile, "but a lot of them had glowing eyes. I wasn't there long enough to ask what they called themselves, since that would have meant explaining that I wasn't a local."
"How did you get anything from them, then?" I couldn't help but ask, since 5 minutes wasn't long enough to do anything.
"I used Terra's stories domain to learn a random guy's life story, including the local language. It's pretty neat, because they talk through a mix of mana and spiritual energy."
I gave a small nod when I heard that. "I'm heading up to check the new map," I said, before ascending to the admin room. I fully expected that Lifra would be joining me soon, so I took my time heading to the couch.
"What's up, Dale?" Michaela asked, having been watching a movie when I appeared.
"Sorry, mind if I hijack the television for a moment? Fior's new floor was just unlocked, so I need to check the map," I asked, to which her eyes widened. Nodding her head, she handed over the remote.
Just as I grabbed it, the door opened and Lifra jumped through. "Don't forget about me,"
I rolled my eyes, aiming the remote at the television, focusing to change the screen to a world map of Fiore's 63rd floor. I stared at the screen for a few moments, processing what I was seeing. There was a complete map, filled with black, white, and silver in organized clusters with rapidly moving lights.
Huh, Acalia blinked. It's an ecumenopolis. I never thought I'd see one this big.
Ecuma! What now?
Lyphra tilted her head in confusion, staring at the screen.
I just see a really big city.
That's it. An ecumenopolis is a city that covers the entirety of a planet's surface. It looks like the race that inhabits this layer has completely urbanized their floor, Acalia pointed out, and I hit another button.
In 3 sections?
That's right. It wasn't just a single worldwide city. Rather, there were 3 cities layered on top of one another. The city that Lyphra's clone entered would have been the central city. The lower city was built underground, containing vast mining networks that linked together the various districts. Finally, the upper layer was built more than 100,000 kilometers above the central city, held in place by what appeared to be advanced engines that controlled natural energy to maneuver. Chapter 91. For the first time in over 20 floors, Fiore had found a new civilized race. More than just that, they actually seemed incredibly advanced. When this news was released, people saw it as a warm welcome amidst all the unfortunate news that had been released in recent weeks. There were admittedly those who were simply waiting for the other shoe to drop, to find out that this race secretly ate babies, or that they were a villainous group that would attack outsiders without warning. Both to investigate this new race and to relieve these tensions, a diplomatic team was organized, consisting of Lyphra, Thelsa, and her shadow team, and a god of insight by the name of Jack Dane. When Lyphra heard that she was assigned to this group, she was beside herself with joy. Literally, she made a clone of herself just so that she could hug herself and dance. Of course, the reason for her assignment was simple, as she was the only one that had experienced visiting that floor and had learned their language. More than that, she understood some of their common sense due to having learned an individual's life story. Thus, Lyphra was asked to gather the rest of the diplomatic team in order to tell them what they all needed to keep in mind. The place of their meeting was none other than Gates Rest, on the 62nd floor. The group sat within a meeting room at the back of the local adventurers' guild, Thelsa and her shadows sitting around one table, with the halfling god that had been assigned to the group. Lyphra, meanwhile, began to pace back and forth, searching through her thoughts to determine what information needed to be shared first.
"Why not just start with their language?" Jack asked.
As a god of insight, he prided himself on being able to pick up any form of information quickly, even deciphering entire languages with only a few sample words.
Oh, sure. I guess we can start there, she said with a nod. Really, there's nothing tricky about their language once you get used to it. Simply mix your mana and spiritual energy in a 4-to-1 ratio and apply it like a thin disc, covering your mouth.
Jack blinked slightly, doing so.
Is this a language that operates by observing the movement of energy, or does the energy itself act as the language?
The second one. The race on the next floor is big on intent. See, with that energy covering your mouth, you just have to talk how you normally would, and the intent behind the words is translated to the other party. To receive the language, you just need the same ratio of energy around your ears. Oh, just watch out, because this also means that lies can't be spoken in this language.
What do you mean? Thelsa asked, curiously.
Put the energy on one of your ears, and I'll show you.
Lyphra smiled brightly. She waited until she sensed the thin layer of energy over one ear for everyone in the room.
I hate adventure. I really do. It's the worst thing in the world, honestly. It's pretty boring.
The people around the table twitched slightly when they heard her speak. Through the ear not covered by the energy, they heard her words normally. However, through the ear that the energy did cover, they heard something entirely different.
I love adventure. I really do. It's the best thing in the world. Honestly, I can't get enough.
It felt weird that not only the words, but even the tone that she said them in, changed when passing through this energy. Lyphra nodded her head once she saw that everyone understood. It does the same thing when you try to deceive by excluding information or twisting facts. In truth, they don't have a language. If you don't use this energy, you'll only hear garbled voices when they talk, like an infant that doesn't know how to properly string words together. That's why I'd like everyone to practice by keeping this energy up for this entire conversation. Petra nodded her head, clearly seeing the value in doing so. I suppose this will make conversation with them a lot easier.
That's right. And this whole intent language has pretty much shaped their culture. The crime rate is pretty low when you can't lie about the fact that you committed the crime. They still have a pretty good army, but that's not specifically for catching criminals. It still does that for when crimes do happen, but there are bigger problems for them to worry about.
Like what? Jack asked, in interest, curious what problems such an advanced race would be facing.
It's actually an old friend of ours. Who here remembers the Thought Bug from the 28th floor? It's a creature that inhabits the mana stones that they mine there. Those same stones are found in the 63rd floor, and in even greater quantities. I don't know whether the bugs come from this floor, or if they're just infesting it through the stones, but they are the biggest threat that the locals face. Just one of these bugs can wipe out a small district if it manages to infect an individual without being noticed. That's why they have their standing army, to kill any of these bugs while curing those that have been infected.
Jack pursed his lips, nodding his head. If I recall, the 28th floor's Rainbow Eyes race had a decent magical civilization, due to having studied these stones. Is that the source of the technology you mentioned in your report?
Lyphra shrugged her shoulders.
Don't know. That's not something your average citizen would really know about in detail. All I know is that their understanding of runes is on par with our own. They even use geometric magic and have begun to dabble with familiars. Admittedly, familiar magic isn't all that popular from what I know. Or maybe the guy I grabbed the information from was just biased. Either way, they've been studying these new forms of magic for a few hundred years now.
Jack nodded his head. It seems like a fairly utopian culture. Did they notice that you were different when you were there?
Oh, no. When you get to floors this high, everyone's an energy being of some variety. The energy that they're made of is actually a much more complex mixture of what we're using to communicate. I just simplified it to help with the process. Because it relies so heavily on intent, it's pretty common for people to change into different shapes. Their true forms most closely resemble elves, but it wouldn't be weird to find a three-headed tentacle monster walking down the street.
The others all just blinked when they heard that.
Okay. Is there anything else that we need to know before we enter? Sora asked,
Lyphra taking a moment to think it over.
They've got great snacks? Also, their own internet. They use portals like we do to make sure that there isn't any noticeable latency, even when you are talking to someone more than 10 billion kilometers away.
Yeah. How are those portals not at risk from the void? Petra suddenly asked.
I don't use the computer all that much, so I never really thought about that.
Jack shook his head, briefly explaining.
They use shielded cables and secure point-to-point transmission within the void itself to make sure that the path of the portals are never exposed to void monsters.
Getting back on topic, Lyphra suddenly interjected. Their system of government involves one local representative for every one of the 10 million districts, a group of 5,000 ministers that oversees the representatives, and a single president that oversees the ministers with selected advisors. All of the major positions are voted in from the lower ranks, so representatives come from normal people, ministers come from representatives, and the president comes from ministers. All positions only last 5 years before the new votes as well.
I don't think we needed to know that part, Maria muttered under her breath.
Of course we do, Lyphra smiled brightly. We'll be entering via District 87. After talking to their representative, we'll need to speak to the minister that oversees them. Once we get their approval, we'll be able to talk to someone speaking on behalf of the president.
Why not the president themselves? Petra asked in confusion.
Just because there's not much crime doesn't mean it's non-existent. Basically, nobody other than his advisors sees the president personally during their term as a matter of safety. Jack massaged his forehead with his fingers, nodding his head.
Still, hopefully the fact that we come from a lower floor will help to speed the process along. Just to be clear, there aren't any mimetic hazards that we need to be concerned with?
That's right, Lifra nodded. The guy I got the information from doesn't have any concept of the void. Their network portals are all done via folding space. Anyways, that should be all that we need to know.
After she said that, Lifra opened up a portal next to herself.
This will take us to the other gate on this floor, and we can all go through together.
The others stood up, with Jack briefly reporting to the guild's branch manager that they were leaving. Once they entered the portal, they all proceeded to walk through the gate. On the other side, they were greeted by neon lights and unrecognizable signs, numerous people walking the paved streets. It didn't take long for the others to realize what they needed to do, covering their eyes with the same energy as their ears and mouths. When they did so, the signs seemed to shift, the text becoming legible. Lifra, meanwhile, was looking around intently. After a few moments, she smiled wide, running over to a man with pointed ears and glowing blue eyes.
"Hello, officer," she proclaimed, the man turning to face her with a gentle expression.
"Hello there. Is there something you'd like to ask about?"
"That's right. I come from a world much unlike this one. Would it be okay if my friends and I went to speak with the local representative?" she asked, keeping that smile on her face as she clasped her hands together.
The officer blinked in confusion, pausing.
"I'm sorry. I'm afraid that I must have misheard you. Could you repeat that?"
"Oh, it's fine," Lifra nodded as the others walked up. "We came here through that black gate you guys use as a tourist attraction. Please, take us to your leader."
The officer froze, not sure how to respond to this.
Lifra simply tilted her head, wondering what was wrong.
"I said, please."
Right. My apologies." He quickly stood up, bringing a finger to his ear and speaking quietly. Of course, his voice couldn't escape the keen ear of the trained adventurers. "I need backup at the Blackstone Square. I believe we may have a few infected individuals claiming to come from another world."
Lifra pouted her lips when she heard the officer's words, about to yell that they weren't infected.
Petra brought a hand to her shoulder, shaking her head. "It's just a formality. Once they realize that we're not infected, we'll be able to get back on schedule."
"Fine. I would like to file a formal complaint, though. I said please and everything."
Chapter 92. The group did not resist when more than a dozen other officers showed up, all seeming prepared for a fight. They peacefully allowed themselves to be escorted through back passages to avoid excessive contact with other citizens. After about 15 minutes of walking, they were brought to a secluded bunker and left alone in a black room. The six of them sat around a single table, waiting. By the time that anyone else came in, the group had gotten bored and started playing cards. The person that entered was a man in a gray suit, his eyes faintly glowing green.
"My apologies for keeping all of you waiting for so long," he said, before noticing the game that they were playing.
Quickly, Petra grabbed the cards and threw them into her shadow, clearing her throat.
"Sorry, we weren't sure when you would get here.
Is there a test that we have to go through now or something?"
The man shook his head.
"All of the testing equipment is embedded within the walls of this room. Had any of you been infected, it would have been detected within minutes. My name is Rajul Kaur, the minister governing this territory. Once I heard of your claims, I came to personally discuss matters with you all."
"Oh, sweet! We get to skip the first representatives," Lifra grinned broadly. "I'm Lifra, servant of the Keeper."
"Jack Dane, god of insight and a delegate assigned to this mission," the halfling male said with a nod.
Petra and the others looked among themselves with a smile before Thelsa spoke up.
"I am Thelsa Whitefallow, and these are my team," she said with a gesture towards the others.
She was being careful with her words, so as not to lie or even appear as though she was withholding information. Without going into extra detail, what she said was accurate.
Rajul nodded his head in greeting once more.
Now, I heard that one among you said that you came from another land, outside of the city?
That's right. That was me.
Lifra nodded her head quickly,
Jack deciding to speak up to elaborate. Specifically, we came from beyond the Black Gate. I understand that it is a tourist attraction in your city. This world is divided into many layers, and certain races can travel between them by passing through the gate.
Certain races. Does that mean that it is impossible for my kind? Rajul asked pensively, but Jack shook his head.
This is left to the will of the Keeper. The Keeper is...
He began, but Rajul lifted a hand to stop him.
The Keeper is a supreme being that governs all lands and races, the origin of life, he said, the others all staring at him in confusion.
My apologies? Did I get that wrong?
No, it's correct. But Petra started, unable to finish until Lifra spoke up.
How did you know that? Nobody has ever known that when we met them for the first time.
Rajul simply smiled again. Quite a long time ago, we began to receive information from the realm of the Thought Bugs, knowledge from a distant place, which introduced foreign terms to us. Among these terms was the concept of the Keeper.
But you didn't know about the gates, Lifra muttered under her breath.
To be precise, we know that there is a gate, but we didn't know its exact form. It is incredibly difficult to decipher the information obtained from that space. If I may ask, how is it that you are able to speak with us? According to our understanding, people from other places should have their own method of communication. Hearing this, Lifra beamed.
That was me. I came here earlier and used my power to get a look at the common knowledge of this city. Speaking of, why didn't I learn that you already knew about the Keeper?
She tilted her head as she came to that question, but Rajul simply chuckled. It's quite simple. In order to prevent unrest within the populace, the existence of certain information is not made public. The existence of the Keeper is only known to a select few researchers, as well as those at the minister rank or above.
That's why you came here as soon as you heard about us, Jack said, in a tone of realization. You must have understood that we were connected to confidential information that most people wouldn't have access to.
Indeed, Rajul showed no intention to deny it. Theoretically, the information could have come from the Thought Bugs, so I made sure to wait until the tests were complete, but it would appear that wasn't an issue. So, back to the previous subject. Is it up to the whims of the Keeper whether or not my people will be able to traverse the gate?
That's right. Lifra nodded her head. Whenever we meet a new race, the big boss man evaluates them, looking at their abilities and general culture. If he believes that the race is a good fit to integrate with the rest of the races he governs, he will make it so that this little blue orb thing appears somewhere within your city. In order to let your race pass through the gates, this orb has to be taken to the very center of this world, where it is absorbed into the central mana spire.
From there, you'll have access to the full system that the world operates under, Petra added on, Lifra rapidly nodding her head.
The system, Rajul closed his eyes in thought.
I believe you are referring to the concept of levels?
Among other things, Jack spoke with a nod, it's helpful that you already know all of this. We haven't met another civilized race in our exploration for quite a while. I believe the last time it took a few weeks before this information was so readily accepted.
Rajul simply smiled. If I may ask, why does this Keeper not simply allow all races to travel freely? Must they be restricted to the area where they were born?
Oh, I can answer this, Lifra said, holding her hand up. It's actually really easy. You see, not all races are friendly. For instance, we've done some calculations, and the race that appears on the other side of the next gate is extremely powerful. Additionally, the last information that we have received from them is that they are highly aggressive. Imagine a living storm that can sweep across an entire district, and then give it a temper.
Rajul hesitated upon hearing this. I see. I had not considered that. In that case, may I ask what I can do to help my people gain access to this system?
Jack and the others all looked at Petra, making it clear to Rajul that only she had the answer to his question.
It's really up to the Keeper.
For instance, he'll look into your race's past and such. I doubt this is the case, but if you were an aggressively expanding race that devoured all land in your path to build your city, it might be harder to get approved. On the other hand, everyone I've met from your people seem really kind. It shouldn't be hard for the Keeper to make his decision. Rajul let out a relieved sigh when he heard this. There have been monsters in the past, but we have long since taken steps to remove them. We discovered that they will only spawn outside of the city, so we spread our city over time to cover the entire world. After that, the only monsters that we have to deal with were the thought bugs.
Is it all right if I ask a question, Minister? Jack spoke up, Rajul looking at him and nodding his head. If you've kept the information of the Keeper silent until now, how are you planning to reveal it to the public? If the system appears, it will appear for everyone at once.
No need to worry. We have long since been prepared for the time when we would release this news. Admittedly, it will surely cause confusion for some time, but I believe that this is a preferable situation for all parties involved.
Right. Petra nodded her head in agreement. By the way, what does your race call themselves, if it's fine for me to ask?
Rajul simply smiled. The people of the city are the Hajit. Is there anything else that you would like to know?
Jack paused briefly before asking, How long are you planning to keep us in this room?
Ah, not to fear. You are free to go at any time after this meeting. I merely wanted to speak with you personally to understand your intentions, whether you were interested in setting up diplomatic relations, or if you were not intending to be here for very long.
I'll need to talk to the Keeper when we get back, but you all seem to be really nice.
Lifra smiled brightly. Rajul's eyes turned towards Lifra, and Jack nodded his head.
The Keeper and his greater pantheon are able to see everything that happens. I'd be surprised if some of them aren't watching this meeting right now, he said, causing Rajul to blink in surprise.
I see. In that case, I do hope for you to put in a good word with us, he said with a smile, turning to walk back towards the door. After he left the door open, a clear sign that they were free to go.
Lifra hopped up from her seat, but Jack put a hand on her shoulder.
Thelsa, can you take us to the gate directly? He suddenly asked, causing the others to look at him in confusion.
What's the matter? Thelsa asked, but did create a black portal next to them.
I'll explain when we're gone, he said, without elaborating. He turned to walk through the portal, the others quickly behind him.
Once they passed through Thelsa's portal, they continued to walk through the black gate. On the other side of the gate, Petra turned to look at Jack with a serious expression.
So, what was it?
We can't let them through so easily. Jack spoke in a solemn tone. From my understanding, the thought bugs have infiltrated the higher echelons of their society. Rajul was planning to pass one to Lifra, before I pointed out that we were being watched.
How do you know that? Lifra asked, eyes wide. Aren't the thought bugs the public enemy of the world? If they had already taken over, why would they still work to cure the infected?
Because they know that they need a public enemy, Jack explained. The first clue was the fact that they had learned about the Keeper through the bug's lair. This implies a deep connection through study. Thought bugs can be considered a form of mimetic entity formed via mana. If you study them deeply enough, it is safe to say that they are studying you as well. When I had this suspicion, I began watching him more closely. When he was asked about his race, he deflected by talking about the people of the city. We learned before that omitting facts can be easily revealed by the energy used to communicate. However, there are still ways around this. Finally, after he said this, I probed him with my divine power in secret and discovered that there were three minds within his body. One of them should have been the true Rajul, while another was the thought bug controlling him. The last one was waiting within his hand. He should have been hoping to infect the one with the highest chance to directly encounter the Keeper.
Lifra let out a low groan. That's a shame. He was really nice. Does that mean it's time for a crusade?
Not necessarily, Petra shook her head. They have methods of cleansing the thought bugs. We just need to use those same methods on the infected people.
First, we should make sure those methods really work, and it's not just the thought bugs playing along. That shouldn't be hard to do, at the very least, Jack said, with a firm nod of agreement. Chapter 93. As Jack had expected, there were actually several of us intently watching this first interaction between our people and the Hajit. To be honest, we didn't immediately take notice of anything unusual. However, when Jack himself started acting strange, as if wanting to cut the conversation short so they could leave, we began scanning things a bit more closely. Naturally, we came to the same conclusion that Jack had, which led to us checking the rest of the Hajit. We did a wide-area scan for any Hajit that were possessed by these thought bugs and compiled them into a list. There were a little over 5,000 in total, with the vast majority being the ministers and president. Aside from them, there were a few random civilians that were hiding from the authorities and people in the upper echelon of their military. On a grand scale, it would be pretty easy to simply wipe these individuals out. However, doing so delicately so as not to create a diplomatic issue with the Hajit was a different matter. Watching this with me were Tara, Aurevi, Akalia, Dana, and Subaki. "Why don't we just abduct them?" Aurevi asked, tilting her head. "If nobody knows where they've gone, nobody can just blame it on us, right?" Akalia shook her head at that. "News will quickly spread that newcomers just came from another realm. If the leading figures all disappeared immediately after that, everyone would point fingers at us, whether it was true or not." "I could replace them with shadow people, maybe," Dana suggested, though this time it was Tara that denied her plan. "The Hajit are an entirely different culture. I don't doubt your ability to impersonate people, but doing so with an unfamiliar culture would likely be noticed." I nodded my head, agreeing with Tara's words. "Right. There's really only one thing we can do from our end, if we don't want this to lead into a major diplomatic dispute. And honestly, with everything that's been going on lately, I would prefer we go a few weeks without something that could threaten the fabric of reality." As I said that, I turned to look at Subaki. "Do you think that you can do it?" Subaki's ears stood up straight as soon as I turned to address her. "Please speak clearly, my keeper. What is it that you wish me to accomplish?" "It's simple. I want you to invade the 63rd floor, hunt down each and every infected individual on our list, and erase the entity invading their mind. Do your best to keep the individuals alive, and have them act as though everything was normal. You'll need to break into incredibly secure facilities to get some of these targets, and one wrong move will cause an all-out war. Although the Hajit are isolated at the 63rd floor, the same can't be said of the creatures possessing them. It's possible that they could find ways to get to us through other floors, so this mission has both the utmost danger and importance." "Which part of that was simple?" Dana retorted with wide eyes, before noticing that Subaki's tail was wagging rapidly. The more that I emphasized the dangers and potential consequences of failure, the more eager she seemed to take it on. "If my keeper were to entrust me with this task, I would surely accomplish it," Subaki declared with a firm nod. I gave a smile at that. "Let's descend so that we can get everything taken care of." 6 hours after the initial meeting between the representatives of Fior and the Hajit, Subaki stood before the gate of the 63rd floor. Her maid uniform was replaced with a black bodysuit, blue lines running along her frame. She focused briefly, altering her body to more closely resemble an elf, removing her tails and causing her eyes to glow white. "I create this covenant with myself, as servant to the Keeper," Subaki spoke under her breath, a silvery light wrapping around her body. "My mission is thus: find the deceivers within the foreign race and weed them out. Until such time, I may not return to my Keeper's side. I may not spare my attention elsewhere. I will become my keeper's hidden blade. In payment, I forego access to all classes that relate to crafting. I forego all classes that relate to gathering. I forego the classes of noble, leader, and gambler. May these restrictions hold until my task is complete." As she finished, she felt the covenant settling, boosting all of her capabilities. Once that was done, she cut open a tear in space, walking through. Although she had brought herself to the gate directly, she couldn't pass through. Being present at the gate was more of a symbolic gesture for her covenant than anything else. After all, she was far too high a level for Fior, and according to Acalia's estimates, she would be until the final floor was achieved and the level limit removed. When Tsubaki arrived at the 63rd floor, she found herself falling through the air, having appeared more than a kilometer above the ground. Such was rather normal, as she had received the coordinates from Lifra, as opposed to visiting the place herself. Nonetheless, she activated her stealth domain, her figure fading from view. She simply allowed her body to continue falling towards the ground. Once she was mere meters from the surface, she rapidly decelerated, flipping to land on her feet. Closing her eyes, she recalled the list of individuals that she needed to investigate, walking down the street. Every now and then she felt a perception sweep across her area, the army on regular patrol, but none of them appeared capable of seeing through her stealth. For now, the problem was that Tsubaki didn't know where her targets were. This city was an incredibly large place, its circumference more than 3 light-years of densely packed urban territory. Furthermore, there were 3 layers of this city, each roughly as large as the others. Of course, she could ask Auravi to take her directly to her targets. Doing so would be quick and efficient. However, there was also the risk of it getting caught with how advanced this layer's civilization was. There was every chance that they had a way to detect power on that scale, which is why Tsubaki wanted to appear away from prying eyes. "Acalia, may your wind guide my hunt," she whispered internally, a faint breeze kicking up. If anyone was around that could see her, they would see Tsubaki's body disappearing into smoke, blown away with the breeze. Using her light domain, she followed the breeze to its destination, briefly surprised when she found what looked like a large tube planted in the ground. "Lady Acalia?" "Hey, don't look at me. Light speed is fast on a small scale, but we're talking light years here. If you don't want to use any type of special teleport, you've got to go with what's available locally. They have billions of these teleport pods scattered all over the city. Just enter it and punch in the 11-digit code for your destination, and it will take you right there." Tsubaki clenched her jaw briefly, but nodded. "Very well. In that case, the code for the pod closest to my first target..." Thankfully, this alien race operated with a base 10 numeral system. Tsubaki quickly typed in the number that Acalia recited, and her vision briefly flickered. Once it had settled, she was already in a new area, the traffic around her pod sprawling. At this layer of Fior, time was somewhat harder to track. The daylight radiating from the central pillar spread out at the speed of light, as did the darkness that followed it. With how large this floor was, that meant that there were roughly 500 different regions of the layer that were in day mode, and 500 that were in night mode, the light moving in an almost rippling pattern. The area that Tsubaki had appeared now was one of the day regions. "Let us try this again. Lady Acalia, may your wind guide my hunt," she repeated, once more vanishing with the breeze that appeared. This time she came to a large building, closing her eyes and scanning through it with her world sight. It didn't take her long to find the figure from the list, the same entity that had previously met with Lifra. At the moment, this man was alone in his office, pacing back and forth. She could sense him communicating with a small entity resting on the desk in front of him. A simple scan was all it took for her to identify this creature as a thought bug. Tsubaki's body dissolved into faint light, passing through the windows of the building and appearing behind the man. She never removed her stealth. Her energy merged with the surroundings. As she watched, hidden in the corner of the room, she began to decipher the communication between the two entities using her world sight. "Are you sure that we weren't being observed?" the minister asked the thought bug, speaking in a tone that could be taken as respectful. "For the 10th time, I sensed no presence observing from outside the room. That is not to say it is impossible, but I have no reason to believe that it was anything more than a bluff. They did not say that someone was surely watching, merely that they would not be surprised if that was the case." Hearing that, the minister let out a long sigh. "Very well.
should we change our plans, if they are truly capable of watching anything?
Doing so is pointless, the thought bug said, in a tone similar to a scoff. To change our plans to avoid the detection of a potentially omniscient entity, we would need all of our members to retreat to the thought world.
That may have been a good idea, Tsubaki's voice spoke up, her divinity isolating this room from the outside world. While they were speaking, Tsubaki had analyzed the structure of the thought worm. Although they had the ability to transmit information over a distance, they were not in constant contact. In fact, Tsubaki believed that such constant contact would make them easier to discover, so it was natural that they only contacted one another as needed. Sure enough, as soon as she appeared, she could feel both entities before her trying to send a distress call. She tilted her head slightly, the power she released capturing these distress signals and snuffing them out. She lifted one hand, flicking a finger towards the bug-like entity on the desk. A white energy flashed out, erasing the bug as she turned towards the minister.
If there is some semblance of your old self that remains within that body, grit your teeth.
This is going to hurt, she said,
before flashing forward and placing a hand on the man's face. A bright light surged from her hand, filling the man's body as she sought out and eradicated every trace of the foreign creature within his body, scorching it with holy light. The minister's scream rang out, filling the office. Thankfully, Tsubaki's power prevented that from leaking out as well. After roughly 5 minutes, Tsubaki brought her hand away from the minister's face, staring down at him. She was certain that she had eradicated every trace of the thought bug that had infected his body. However, she did not know if that was enough. If the creature was able to brainwash its host over a long period of time, he might still try to serve its agenda even after being freed. If that was the case, then Tsubaki would have to take her time re-educating each minister that she freed. The minister seemed to feel a chill as Tsubaki thought about that, looking up to meet her glowing gaze.
Who are you?
He asked in a shaky tone.
Not somebody you want to lie to. Now, we're going to have a talk.
Chapter 94. As Tsubaki left the office where she had been interrogating the minister, there was a grim expression on her face. As she had feared, there was a mind alteration process involved when it came to the hosts of the thought bugs. Fortunately, it wasn't complete brainwashing, but it was still a problem.
Lady Akalia, I presume that you witnessed all of that? She asked internally.
She initially wanted to communicate with the Keeper directly, but it seemed that her covenant not only forbid her from returning to his side, but also direct communication.
I did. How do you plan to take care of it?
When Akalia asked that, Tsubaki closed her eyes, letting herself blend into the surroundings. Although the thought bugs did not brainwash their hosts into being their followers, they altered their memories. Any memory related to the bugs themselves would shift, leaving them unaware of any involvement on the part of these creatures. When she had purged the bug from the minister, he nearly went into a panic, shouting about who she was and how she had managed to get into his office. The reason behind this situation, as far as Tsubaki could tell, was because there were a limited number of thought bugs living within the city. Thus, although the hosts might get promoted, the bugs themselves would maintain their previous roles. A minister would always be a minister, and the president would always be the president. On that note, Tsubaki strongly suspected that the bug that they had wanted to infect the Keeper with was none other than the president, as it would put that bug in the highest seat of power possible. However, there was no method to directly confirm this, as questioning the host was pointless.
I'll target all of the ministers first, and then the president, if he is still infected with his. However, I'll have to be faster than this. I can't waste time convincing each minister about what had happened and having them pretend to still be infected. 5,000, right?
She muttered to herself, before closing her eyes. apologize to my keeper on my behalf. I believe I will need to borrow a portion of his energy in order to execute this mission.
What are you planning to do?
I have not forgotten my nature, Lady Acalia.
Tsubaki let out a long sigh, opening her eyes and moving into a nearby alley.
I am quite the restless fox.
As she said that, dozens of specks of light began to break off from her body, turning into silver spheres that illuminated the alley. She had to use her divine domain to mask the entrance of the alley, preventing anyone from noticing what was going on within.
You know, I have a really hard time taking you seriously when you say stuff like that,
Acalia responded, her voice cracking up slightly in amusement. Tsubaki's brow twitched, once again regretting the title that the system had given her legend. Unfortunately, there was no helping it. As such, she focused, conjuring more and more of her avatars. It was unreasonable to attempt to carry out all 5,000 attacks at once. However, 500 attacks was another matter. Tsubaki could feel the pull on her divinity from creating so many clones of herself, and borrowed power from her connection with the Keeper in order to fulfill her objective.